Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Mimi Reed about her new book, Tom Shearer Decorates, and Jonathan Klein about his first novel, The Wisdom of Ashes. New Orleans writer Mimi Reed has one of those bylines that you've probably seen in one of your favorite newspapers or magazines, like the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, Oh, the Oprah Magazine, The New Yorker, House Beautiful, Elle Decor, Food and Wine, Travel and Leisure. Wow, Mimi. And now you can read more of her work in her very first book, The Gorgeous Tom Shearer Decorates. Mimi, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, nice to see you, Susan.
Wow. What a gorgeous book this is. After I finished it, I was dreaming of unusual wallpaper and painted furniture. You know, it's just so beautiful.
Decorating books are pretty irresistible. A lot of them are. And this is a beautiful one. Tom is just very talented. I've always loved his work and his ideas.
And now, after you look at this book, you feel almost as if you would walk into a room, and if it were his room, you would know. You would recognize it.
He's definitely got a signature. He's got a point of view. Not all decorators do. A lot of them just sort of make a lot of random decisions and call it a room. And Tom has a point of view. There's reasons behind what he does. He's got this computer of a brain, and by the time he feeds it all of the information, appropriateness, context, architecture, the people who live there, their real lives, there are only one or two answers. And so the room really ends up looking a certain way.
And how did you get to know him? You have worked with him for a long time on this book.
20 years ago, a magazine called House and Garden, now defunct,
sadly,
sent me to Charleston, where Tom had recently bought a house. He's an inveterate New Yorker, but he had bought his first house in Charleston, and he was in his late 30s. He was making himself into a decorator. He wasn't quite there yet, but he had done over this house in Charleston. It was very beautiful. I saw it. It looked like nothing else at the time. It was full of modern things and antiques and all of it put together in this incredibly breezy, easy way that didn't look formal or fancy and yet looked correct and beautiful. And I wound up staying with him. He wouldn't let me stay in a hotel. He said they were all terrible. So I checked into his third floor, and we would drink a lot of coffee in the morning and talk for hours and hours, and we became friends immediately. And over the years, various magazines had me write about him until it became embarrassing, because you can't write about someone
over and over again.
Over and over again, and got to know him.
And when does a designer decide, or when do you decide, that it's time for a book like this, that they've accomplished enough or built a body of work? What are the things that go into deciding that?
I think it's different for all decorators. In Tom's case, I don't think he was sitting around thinking about a book. He's a pretty busy guy. He's weirdly unambitious for someone so successful. And in this case, Mark McGowan, the publisher of Vendome, contacted Tom and asked him to do a book. Mark is someone who is unusually attuned to decorating. He lives on the Upper East Side in a building that was a Rosario Candela building, which is a big deal in New York. And he's had serious decorators do his apartment over the years, including Colfax and Fowler, a legendary English design firm. So he's aware of decorators and decorating in a way that maybe many publishers aren't. And he asked Tom to do the book, and Tom looked around and saw that indeed every other decorator seemed to have a book and thought that perhaps he would go along with it.
It would be nice. Yeah. I'm sure he likes his book very much.
So he asked me to write it, and we actually had a great time. We would hole up in my house in New Orleans and work in our pajamas all day long and then go to Galatoire's, and that quickly became our working method.
Oh, that's a good one.
And then we did it in Paris.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, it was fun. I had a good time writing this book.
You know, this kind of writing demands a certain kind of empathy, a certain kind of language, a certain kind of ability to describe someone's artistry. I mean, you've been doing this for a long, long time, haven't you?
I have. I've been writing for these design magazines for about 25 years, shockingly. I never intended to do it. It just happened. I took a job in New York for a paper called New York Newsday when I was in my late 20s. And the job that was open was for the home section. And I thought, well, I'll do this for 2 years and then I'll wait for a general assignment reporting position to open up. And somehow it was just very comfortable for me writing about home. I wrote about a lot of artists' houses. I liked particularly writing about artists' houses. And I think it's something, you know the person who lives in the house through the house. It's a portrait. It's just a way of doing a profile of someone, really. And you bring to it what you bring to writing about any profile, an interest in culture, an interest in art, an interest in psychology. I think psychology is particularly important when you're writing about people's houses, to understand them and what their aspirations are and how they want to present themselves, because that's really what it's about.
Oh, how does this make you feel about your own house, though? Does it make you want to go home and throw everything out or redecorate every 6 months? How does that work for you?
I have two decorators on speed dial. They're friends of mine. One of them is Tom. One of them is a local decorator named Melissa Rufty. And I would never, for instance, paint my house without talking to one of them because it's too big a thing. And color is completely impossible and mercurial and maddening. And they know how to do it. They're professionals. This is what they do. And so, the same goes for buying a sofa or anything significant. I don't think I would do it at this point in my life without talking to one of these professionals. I admit that I am fortunate and that I have these kind of people that I can, bother with this small stuff. But on the other hand, I've never had a decorator. And I think I've been influenced as much by my brother, who's an art dealer in New York, the furniture my parents left to me, growing up in New Orleans and what I've seen in New Orleans, my love of books. I think all of these things inform my house. It's not just decorating, but decorating, I've focused on it so long. How could it not have made an impression on me? And I get a kick out of it, and I enjoy it. My days of being judgmental about decorating are long gone.
So you talked about your love of books, and this book has a lot of wonderful libraries in it. That's one of the things I enjoy the most about it. There's one particularly gorgeous library that's red. Tell us about that one.
The Red Library is in a Brooklyn house. And it was for a couple that had three Red Libraries. Tom had done all three of them. And they just liked that. They were comfortable with that. They were traditional people who also liked things done with a bit of, aplomb. So that's what they wanted. But I think the thing about decorating in libraries is there's a bit of a joke in it. There's that wonderful scene in Auntie Mame where Patrick brings his girlfriend Gloria to Auntie Mame's house for the first time, and she walks in and she says, "Oh, what a stunning apartment. Books are so awfully decorative, aren't they?" And I think that most designers, not all, but most designers approach libraries as decorative projections, and they buy books by the yard. There's actually a company on the internet called Books by the Foot. You can order extremely distressed leather by the foot. You can order books about art by the foot so that you can project whatever impression you want to project to people. It's perfect for the well-dressed Philistine, I guess you'd say.
Oh, no. And you see those pictures of people who've covered all their books with white paper.
That's another one. And that was maybe the 90s when the all-white room was the rage.
Right.
And people would have white slip covers and white floors and white walls. And they covered their books in white paper. And I never forget the first assignment where I was called upon to write about a library full of books covered in white paper. And I said, how do you find anything? But that apparently isn't the point.
Right. I don't think so.
So, but Tom is, I think, more attuned to matters of authenticity. He doesn't buy books for people. They tend to have books. Libraries to him are a place to properly house them and give them good lighting so that people can sink into squishy sofas and sit there and actually consult them.
And one of the things he does that I particularly liked is that he uses these kind of floating box shelves that just seem suspended there, you know, in stacks. And they're really kind of wonderful.
Those are really great because they don't clutter up the floor. You hang them on the wall and you put books in them. I think maybe West Elm has copied them. One of the mass market house stores has copied them and you can now buy them. But he's often done stuff and had it knocked off by West Elm. It always amazes me. I always say, don't you care? Why don't you mass produce these things? And he says, eh.
That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work, exactly. And basically, he's part slacker.
Oh, well, one of the things I love about this book is that it's divided into three parts: city, country, tropics. And in the tropical section, there's a lot of wonderful stuff in Florida. And in one of those houses, there's this tower of a bookcase. That's what I want mass produced. Pass that along.
Interesting.
It's so tall and round. It's amazing.
He made that up. It's made out of teak. He had it made in India. That's Mark McGowan, the publisher of Vendome's, condo in Miami, right? I think it's in Miami. And it's a new kind of high-rise-y condo where they have these great rooms. And I think the apartment itself lacked architecture. It lacked a certain gravitas. And so Tom was trying to divide up that room as you walk in into areas. And he was trying to give it a dining area, a living area. And the teak tower, right as you walk in, it sort of makes this big statement, takes your mind off the fact that the ceilings are low and the, you know, the architecture isn't great. And it subdivides the flow in the room and it creates other spaces.
And then everything flows around it. It was really gorgeous. Well, we've been talking with Mimi Reed, whose glorious new book is Tom Shearer Decorates. And it's number one in the Amazon design book list right now, right?
It is the top selling interior design book on Amazon. And Tom had to teach me how to look up such stats on the internet. And now I do it every day. It's like texting. Once you learn how to do it, there's absolutely no end to it. And it's fascinating to see which books are selling and which books aren't.
Well, we'll be watching to see that it stays there. Thank you so much, Mimi.
Thanks, Susan.
Jonathan Klein is a longtime New Orleans poet and storyteller. He's with us today to talk about his new book, an interconnected series of short stories called Wisdom of Ashes. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Susan.
I'm glad to have you on.
Oh, it's really great to be here.
I love these stories. They are so filled with real New Orleans characters, characters anyone will recognize or believe in. How did they come to you? Has this been percolating a long time for you?
No, not really. I lived here in the 80s, so I knew a few of the people. And I kind of started there. And then as fiction is, you know, it kind of takes on a life of its own. You never know what the characters are going to do or where they're going to go.
A lot of people don't know that. They do act independently, don't they?
They do.
So tell us about some of the people in your book, in your stories. And the dog.
There's a dog named Dummy. Boy, there's a lot of people in it. There's a Slovenian puppet maker named Bruno. There's two poets. There's a nun who writes poetry. There's Kenneth, who's a mousy little man. Yeah, there's more people than I can even remember, really. So the main people are the two poets. There's a psychiatric nurse, the devil.
The devil, yes. Now, my favorite character is the thief, Abby.
Oh.
I love her.
I'm glad. I love her, too.
So I wonder if you'd describe a little bit of her personality and her progress in the world.
Well, she's an artist, and she steals unimportant things, little bits of this and that, fabric or springs, things that she finds that are really of no use to anyone else. And she breaks into a building and walks around. No one's been in the building for years and years. And eventually she meets the building owner. Who's waiting for her. She's a very beautiful girl. And I don't want to give away too much.
By the time the story ends, she's become a thief of important things.
That's right.
So I love that whole atmosphere of that story. I can see it in my mind's eye when I read it. There's this dreamy quality about New Orleans that you seem to have captured perfectly in the stories. How does the city function as your muse?
New Orleans really has a life of its own, you know. One of the things that is real clear in the stories is that it's so easy to be alone in New Orleans. Like, you can walk out your door and look around, there's nobody around for blocks and blocks and blocks. And that's different about New Orleans than other cities. Most other cities, you walk out your door, there's plenty of people, they're walking around, they're doing things. But New Orleans, because it's all neighborhoods, nobody might be awake in your neighborhood.
And there's a special kind of New Orleans energy that you capture when someone walks out the door and all is not as it should be.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I guess I've noticed. And I don't think that New Orleans people notice it because, I mean, I'm not from here. So there's a thing when the city's just not right. Sometimes the city is very right. It's like, woo, the city's right tonight. And sometimes it's just there's something off. You can feel it.
And then you go back inside.
That's right.
I mean, and there's a sadness to some of these stories, to a lot of these stories. Was that hard for you to write?
Sometimes. Some of the stories really still affect me, even though I wrote them. Like this, there's a story about a little boy crossing the street, and it gets to me every time. And it's like, wow, I wrote this. But yeah, there is a sadness to it, and they're sad stories, I guess.
I love that story about the little boy crossing the street to catch up, because it's that moment in a child's life when everything can go terribly, terribly wrong or terribly, terribly right. And as you read it, you're kind of poised on the brink, on the edge with this kid. And it's such another recognizable New Orleans moment. And tell us about the title.
Well, the title is in one of the poems. I can't remember exactly how it got there. It had several titles at different points, as a book will, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't interpret things very much, really. So if someone wants to interpret what the Wisdom of Ashes means to New Orleans, I mean, there's something about ashes. You know, it's Ash Wednesday. That's an important day in New Orleans. I mean, my wife Gina tells me that if you really do Mardi Gras, that you have to drag yourself out of bed on Wednesday and get your ashes and go to work. You don't get Wednesday off. And that's kind of part of it, is that the wisdom of the world's right side up now.
And that's Gina Ferrara, the poet,
mm-hmm.
I should say.
Yes.
You've done all kinds of things. You've taught visual arts. You've trained in the visual arts. You've written poetry as well. What was the attraction of short stories for you? What drew you to this form for this book?
Well, I'm a storyteller by education. I have a MFA in time art. And in time art from the School of Art Institute of Chicago, I basically studied storytelling.
Is that what time art is?
No, time art is...
What is time
all
art?
All kinds of things. Time art is four-dimensional art. That is art that exists in time, from kinetic sculpture to video installation to sound installation to storytelling to performance art that doesn't quite make it in the world of performance art. All of it falls under time art. So as a storyteller, you know, I developed a system of telling oral tales, very long autobiographic oral tales. So fiction is really kind of new to me. Really, I can only write about 600 words before it's just the story ends. I don't know how other people do it. I don't know how people sit down and write, you know,
thousands of words.
So each story sort of has its own little end.
And this is a very beautiful book. I mean, I know that as a visual person, that's important to you. And you published this book with Bill Lavender, Lavender Inc.
Yes.
So what was that process like for you? Bill, I think, is a great publisher who knows how to make a beautiful book.
Yeah. We worked together on the cover. I made the photograph and Bill did the graphics. A guy named Jeff Munsterman did the layout of the book. All of them, I think, just did a great job. I just couldn't be happier with the cover. Bill and I worked quite a bit on what the cover picture would be. And finally I said, how about this one? And he's like, great.
You know it. You know it when it's right. Yeah. You always do. It's a very beautiful book. We've been talking with Jonathan Klein, whose new short story collection is The Wisdom of Ashes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
It's amazing how often books and love are intertwined in songs. Peter Gabriel, who often draws inspiration from poetry, conjures a romantic proposal in the Book of Love with its refrain, "I love the way you read to me."
The Book of Love is long and boring. No one can lift the damn thing. It's full of charts and facts and figures and instructions for dancing, but I love it when you read to me, and you can read me anything. Book of Love has music in it. In fact, that's where music comes from. Some of it's just transcendental. Some of it's just really dumb. But I love it when you sing to me, and you can sing me anything. Love is long and boring, and written very long ago. It's full of flowers and heart-shaped boxes, and things we're all too young to know. But I love it when you give me things, and you ought to give me wedding rings, and I love it when you give me things, and you ought to give me wedding rings. things.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Writing Institute at the Arts Council of New Orleans will offer a 12-week workshop in fiction and creative nonfiction taught by writer James Nolan. It meets Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 9, September 25th through December 11th. Registration is underway. For more information, visit artscouncilofneworleans.org or email jnolan77@bellsouth.net. The West Bank Writers Group meets every Tuesday at 6 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. James Greer signs his new collection of short fiction, Everything Flows, Tuesday, September 10th at 7 at Maple Street Bookshop. Pat Kogo signs her book, Priory, Louisiana, Tuesday, September 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And here's something fun. The Jefferson Parish Library will hold its first adult spelling bee, Wednesday, September 11th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, novelist Jonathan Klein, signs The Wisdom of Ashes, Wednesday, September 11th at 7 at Café Istanbul. And I hope you'll come out and see me when I sign the revised edition of my Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans, Thursday, September 12th at 6 at Octavia Books, and again Saturday, September 14th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. The Walker Percy Center for Writing and Publishing will present Mark LaFleur, reading from his debut novel, Elysian Fields, Friday, September 13th at 1:30 in the living room of Loyola's Monroe Library. The New Orleans Review, published at Loyola University, will have a launch party for its fall issue Friday, September 13th at 7 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans gets its new year underway with a discussion of books 1 to 7 of David Copperfield, Saturday, September 14th from 2 to 4 at the Metairie Park Country Day School's Bright Library. The Scholastic Writing Awards of Southeast Louisiana will hold their fundraiser Sunday, September 15th, with a free launch party at 4 p.m., followed by a gala at 5:30 at the University of New Orleans Homer Hitt Visitor and Alumni Center. Check out gnowp.org, that's for the Greater New Orleans Writing Project, for more information and tickets. And Poppy Tooker and photographer David Spielman signed Louisiana Eats, Tuesday, September 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Robert Kayette signs The Education of a Lifetime, Tuesday, September 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Fiat Lux Book Club, devoted to exploring the influence of Catholicism on writers, discusses the first half of Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory, Tuesday, September 17th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. And Sue Campbell discusses and signs Conversations in Heaven, The Amazing Journey of Five Unique Heavenly Beings, Tuesday, September 17th at 7 at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.